Hello, I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly. On today's show, games, brains and automobiles. What happens when a computer games developer turned neuroscientist teams up with a group famed for its work on taxi drivers? We catch up with NASA's chief climate scientist, Jim Hansen, who's been in Britain for a protest march. And it's life, but not as we know it. One of the world's leading experts describes his hopes and fears for the future of synthetic biology. And in other news, Britain's chief scientist warns us to prepare for a perfect storm caused by shortages of food, water and energy, a medical implant that could treat Parkinson's disease, how mistakes at the Forensic Science Service might have kept an innocent man in prison for 10 years, and fossil hunters in the Arctic unearth the remains of what they called the Tyrannosaurus Rex of the oceans. With us in the pod to help us through the week in science are The Guardian's Nell Bowes and environment correspondent David Adam. Welcome you two. Doing well?
Doing very well.
Yes, very well, thanks.
Good to hear it. But our guest today is Demis Hassabis. Demis has worn a lot of hats for a man of his age. He became a chess master at the age of 13, has worked on artificial intelligence in the computer games industry, and just yesterday had his viva for his PhD in cognitive neuroscience at University College London. Dr. Hassabis, I hope you're deeply hungover and regret agreeing to come on the programme.
Yes, well, I'm not at the best of times. I'm not that good in the mornings anyway, so it's probably not making much difference.
I should explain this reference to automobiles in my introduction. You now work with Eleanor Maguire at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at UCL. And a while back, she showed that London taxi drivers have a slightly different brain structure to the rest of us, presumably from doing the knowledge. We discussed your latest work on the programme last week, but can you just recap what you did for those who weren't listening?
Sure. What we did was get four volunteers, and whilst we were scanning their brains, we got them to effectively play a computer game, which was a bespoke virtual reality environment where the idea of what they had to do was to navigate as quickly as possible between four positions in two virtual reality rooms. One was green, one was blue. Very simple rooms. And whilst they were doing that, they were lying in the scanner and we were acquiring brain scans. And then afterwards, we trained up various pattern recognition algorithms with the brain scans. And then we used those algorithms to accurately predict where somebody was standing in the room just from their brain activity.
So there are cells in the brain that will record our position, but not exactly where we are, presumably just the type of environment we're in.
Well, so we know from animal studies on rats mostly that there are cells in the brain, especially in the part of the brain called the hippocampus, which they've been dubbed as play cells, which actually activate when a rat actually steps over a particular place in an environment. So we know that, but we don't know what a population of, say, several hundred thousand of those cells might look like, or how, or what kind of information they encode. And that's something that we were trying to investigate with the neuroimaging, which is obviously taking a picture of the whole brain at once. So although it's not got very good resolution compared to single cell recording in rats, for example, you do get an idea of what the whole population of cells are doing.
And the media inevitably describe this as a step towards mind reading. And why do you think that idea is so compelling? Why do you think we did that? What's your take on it?
So I think mind reading is a very compelling story, I guess, or an angle on things, because, you know, I think people like to think that at least the privacy of their own thoughts is you know, the final sort of a frontier, if you like, that, you know, that's private to themselves. And I guess it makes people uneasy to think that perhaps, you know, there's some way of reading that out. And I guess it also has implications for what consciousness is and what intelligence is, and, you know, and the nature of who we are, really, if you can start reading things out, you know, in a mechanical way that are as personal as thoughts. So I think there's a, you know, and there's also, I guess, a science fiction sort of sensationalist element to it as well. Plus, there's the whole Big Brother, you know, worry that we have anyway with, you know, CCT cameras everywhere. And, you know, that's maybe this is just another step towards that. So I think there's all those kind of reasons, you know, merged together.
Science has been talking about artificial intelligence for decades now, and it seems to be a sort of a field that moves in fits and starts, probably like anything else. But when do you think we will, or do you think we will, have computers that will ever be sort of genuinely intelligent?
Well, I don't see any reason why not. I mean, you know, it seems that the more we find out about the mind, the more sort of structured and almost mechanical, actually, it seems, which is a little bit scary on one hand, you know, if you want to believe in the special sort of status of the mind. But, you know, there are all sorts of studies from, you know, people working on on motor reflex that find that the brain reacts before, you know, they consciously report moving their finger, for example. You know, the brain is already making that action. So, you know, it makes you stop and think. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot of interesting things to go. But in artificial intelligence itself, I think that the whole field's been a little bit stagnant for the last, I would say, maybe 20 years since the advent of neural networks, which is the last sort of big major advance. And I think that it may be the time's, you know, ripe now for another injection of ideas. And that's really why one of the reasons why I switched into cognitive neuroscience was to maybe get some inspiration from how the brain works to inspire, you know, new ideas in artificial intelligence.
Nell, you've got a question?
Yeah, I was going to say, so give us a couple of those new ideas. What's going to be the next breakthrough?
On the spot.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things that that I've got planned, but I guess one of the things that struck me very early on in my PhD was that you know, a lot of people working on neural networks and in the computer science field on those kinds of technologies assume have very simplified views of how the brain does it. So neural networks are supposed to be very loosely based on how neurons work, and pretty much most state-of-the-art neural networks, certainly up to the last few years, have used connections in them that are basically modeled on one certain type of neuron, which is called an excitatory neuron. So the excitatory neurons are neurons that when they fire, any other neurons they're connected to, they cause those ones to fire as well. Now, it turns out when you look at what the brain has and is what the brain's doing, that around 20-30% of the neurons in the brain are actually inhibitory neurons. So i.e. they're neurons that when they fire, they actually turn off all the neurons that they're connected to, not turn them on. So, and you know, evolution and biology in general doesn't waste a lot of energy doing things that are not important. And 30% of the brain matter, that's a huge amount of resource to devote to something that, you know, it must be critical because it's completely pervasive in the brain. These inhibitory neurons, they're everywhere. So, so it's just things like that. We don't understand yet what they do in the brain, but certainly it's something we should be considering in artificial intelligence about, you know, building into our models.
Demis, we'll come back to some of that later on in the program, but for now, thank you. NASA's chief climate scientist, Jim Hansen, has become one of the most outspoken and uncompromising voices on the environment. Last week, he was in Britain to join protesters in a demonstration against the power company E.ON. Our environment correspondent, David Adam, caught up with him and asked what people can do to help in the fight against climate change.
The first action that the public should take is, of course, to use the democratic process. Now, I think what is frustrating people, me included, is that the democratic action does have affects elections, but what we get then from political leaders is what we call greenwash rather than actions that are effective. In the U.S., I've realized recently there are 2,400 lobbyists in Washington on the energy issue. So the democratic process is supposed to be, you know, one person, one vote, but it turns out that money is talking louder than the votes. I think a peaceful demonstration is not out of order at this point because we're running out of time.
Now, in Europe, it's quite tempting to look to your country and the recent election and see a saviour there when it comes to climate change. Are we right to think that Barack Obama could yet turn this around?
There's the potential of that, but it's not yet at all clear that there is the intention to do that. There is, I think, a great danger. I mean, it remains to be seen what the position is going to be. But if they are going to support a cap and trade, I think that it's going to be, unfortunately, another case of greenwash.
Are there any politicians that we should look to as doing the right thing? Are there any governments or people that you know of that are talking along the right lines?
That's the discouraging thing, in the sense that, you know, when I went to these several different countries, which you would have thought offhand would be the greenest, and Germany, the United Kingdom, and Japan, none of them have plans that are consistent with the degree of and rapidity of change that we need. And the United States position needs to be clarified, but I'm becoming concerned about that.
David, so democracy isn't working?
It's quite a big statement, isn't it? Jim Hansen is clearly at one extreme of the spectrum on climate change. Now, some people would say he's an extremist. Some people would even say he's sort of very almost fundamentalist on climate change. But I think he's been doing it a lot longer than most. He's been aware of these issues a lot longer than most. And so you could also say that he's just ahead of the curve. And he's saying now what everyone will be saying in 10 years, because he was saying 10 years ago what everyone is saying now. And I think his point about democracy is that it's not as crude as democracy isn't working. It's just that if you want governments are the only people who are able to bring about the kind of change in emissions that we need to solve this problem. And he says that the position of governments is compromised because they have to look after the corporate interests.
But if Jim Hansen was in charge, what would he do? Because it seems if he's saying we need to, the things we've got lined up to tackle climate change are too little, too late. We need to do far more drastic stuff. But how does he actually propose doing that kind of thing?
He effectively wants a carbon tax. He wants China, Europe, the US, and others, but mainly those three blocks, to get together and to agree to put what is euphemistically called a price on carbon, but actually means a tax. You make it expensive to emit carbon dioxide. And the idea being then that if you're an energy company, you're not going to build a coal-fired power station because it's going to cost you a fortune to run it. So instead, you build windmills.
Let's leave that there. Now, with a rundown of news from the world of science, here's Nell and David with the News Jam. News
Jam! A perfect storm of food shortages, scarce water, and insufficient energy resources threatened to unleash public unrest, cross-border conflicts, and mass migration as people flee from the worst affected regions, so warns the UK government's chief scientist. In a major speech to environmental groups and politicians, Professor John Beddington, who took up the position of chief scientific advisor last year, said the world is heading for major upheavals which are due to come to a head in 2030. He told the government's Sustainable Development UK conference in Westminster that the growing population and success in alleviating poverty in developing countries will trigger a surge in demand for food, water and energy over the next two decades, at a time when governments must also make major progress in combating climate change.
A groundbreaking medical device that eliminates the symptoms of Parkinson's disease by electrically stimulating the brain could be tested in humans as early as next year, according to scientists working on the project. The device has produced dramatic improvements in mice with a Parkinson's-like disease, raising hopes that it could transform the lives of the 4 million people worldwide who have the devastating condition. In tests, mice that suffered constant tremors and were barely able to walk because of the disease started moving around, groomed themselves, and began eating and drinking normally when the device was switched on.
Vital evidence, which could have secured the release of an innocent man, was held in a forgotten forensic science archive on an industrial site in the Midlands, The Guardian reveals. Sean Hodgson walked free after 27 years in jail when his murder conviction was quashed on Thursday. But an inquiry is being launched into why the Forensic Science Service wrongly told defence lawyers acting for him in 1998 that exhibits in the inquiry had been destroyed. The Court of Appeal was told that had his legal team acquired the exhibits, they would have submitted them for DNA testing, which in all likelihood would have secured his release 11 years ago.
The remains of a giant, meat-eating sea monster that patrolled the oceans during the reign of the dinosaurs have been unearthed on an island in the remote Arctic archipelago of Svalbard. Norwegian fossil hunters recovered the rear half of the formidable reptile skull in southwest Spitsbergen, in what has been described as one of the most significant Jurassic discoveries ever made. The predator has been identified as a new species of pliosaur, a group of extinct aquatic reptiles that had huge skulls, short necks, and four flippers to power them through the water.
David, Nell, thanks very much for that. Let's pick up a couple of those stories. And I know you just want to talk about the sea monster. But David, what do you make of John Beddington's perfect storm warning?
I think it's interesting. I think a lot of these topics have been talked about in isolation, a lot, some of them. You know, certainly the food crisis and the energy crisis, not so much the water crisis, although potentially that's the most serious of all of them. And I think it is quite scary to think that they could all strike at the same time. And I suppose he's just joining the dots on what other people have sort of pieced together. And I mean, I think it's quite striking that someone in his position would say this. It's just far enough away that it means the government of the day doesn't have to do anything about it, of course. So he's almost sort of served his political masters. If he'd said there was a perfect storm in 2020, then that causes real problems because the government has to start putting policies in place.
I don't know if any of you have been following the Sean Hodgson case, but I was really struck by this story that came out of that, where the Forensic Science Service had apparently been called up to see by the police to see if they had any remaining evidence left over from that case 10 years ago. And apparently they replied that they'd thrown it all out, only to find out very recently that actually they did still have the evidence, and it was the evidence that cleared him. And this was a man who has been in prison for the best part of 30 years. And it just shocked me that there wasn't some clearly accountable, robust mechanism within the Forensic Science Service and within the perhaps the judicial system in how these kinds of things are dealt with. I mean, the Forensic Science Service seemed to say that they've not found any particular evidence of having a request for this.
But are we saying, is the query, do they have any kind of robust archiving system, or is it simply that this one slipped under the radar and it's a terrible tragedy, but you cannot be infallible?
But it's a shocking thing to have slip under the radar. We're talking about 10 years of a man's life.
But you're talking about how many trials each year, hundreds of thousands, and the idea that you can keep track of absolutely every piece of evidence. It, you know, yes, it's awful, it's a tragedy, but I wonder whether the fact that it's had a terrible outcome in this case is leading people to ask for unrealistic...
Well, I think they have to work out what happened. I mean, I agree with you, we can't expect people to be infallible, but if they're fallible in this case, we need to know why and to make our damn sure it won't happen again. I mean, I think it's quite tempting to think, even the name Forensic Science Service sort of conjures up images of shiny labs and machines, and I'm sure it's not. I'm sure they're just a giant warehouse, the kind you see
with
on TV when the detective goes down and asks for the evidence and they rifle through all these files and folders.
It's a bit like The Wire.
I'm sure it is like that.
Okay, let's wrap that up there. For all our science news and blogs, go to guardian.co.uk/science. 3 years ago, staff at MIT in Boston voted to introduce a new course. Nothing so unusual about that, you might think, but it was the first time they'd done so in nearly 30 years. The course was to be called Biological Engineering, and its aim was to teach a new generation of scientists to build things with the molecules of life. Since then, the field has grown and is now at the stage where scientists are trying to create living organisms from scratch. One of the field's leading lights, Drew Endy, recently moved from MIT to Stanford University in California. I caught up with him at the recent AAAS meeting in Chicago and asked him why scientists are so keen to turn biology into engineering.
Biology is the most impressive technology platform we've ever encountered for manufacturing stuff. If you look at the living world, it's just unbelievable what it can do. Not only ourselves, but even something as quote-unquote simple as a leaf. If you stop and think about a leaf, it's a self-assembling solar panel. And you think about all the expenses and costs associated with going to solar energy. Somehow, nature has provided us an example of a technology platform which is vastly superior to anything we're now familiar with as engineers.
So is this a kind of super form of GM, if you like? Instead of manipulating individual genes, you're now looking at the whole biological circuitry.
Well, you know, recombinant DNA technology has been around for 35 years, more or less. And it's one of the key tools of biotechnology that's used in genetic engineering projects. As a tool, it's a pretty primitive tool, meaning it allows you to cut and paste pre-existing fragments of genetic material. What synthetic biology brings to the table are whole new tool platforms. So as one example, you could look at DNA synthesis, where you can compile from raw materials, which are basically modified sugars, new pieces of DNA. You're not modifying pre-existing pieces of DNA, you're making a new piece of DNA. Now, new doesn't mean that the information, the resulting sequence, is absolutely new. If I could synthesize DNA from scratch, which we can and are getting much better at, what that allows is for a decoupling in the process of engineering. You could have one person who's a designer and another person who's a constructor or a builder. If you think about actual buildings, you'll have one person who's an architect They figure out the design, the information, the specification of the building to be assembled. And you have a second person or persons who are the team that actually physically erect and validate the building. So is it a super form of genetic engineering or genetic modification? Super in what sense? It certainly allows us to do much, much more. It certainly allows more people to participate and to become experts in it so that we should be able to do more impressive, more important feats, hopefully also more safely. But it's also a very young field and immature, with a lot of these tools still to be developed and with a lot of ideas still to be explored.
A lot of groups have come up with concerns about this kind of work, and they point to a few examples where people have built viruses and such like in the labs and said, what if these things come out? Do you think these are groups latching onto a new technology just for the sake of it, or do you think some of these concerns are valid?
I think the concerns are quite valid, but limited in scope right now. So if we were to talk about one specific example, we could focus on DNA synthesis. Could you use the ability to synthesize new genetic material from scratch as a way to construct new types of biological threats? The answer is yes, but in a very limited sense, and we can be quite specific. Things that we don't know where they exist in nature, like Ebola, if you could get access to the information, maybe you could make it more easily than waiting for the next outbreak and risking death. Things that are locked up, like smallpox, if you could get access to the information, then maybe you could remake it. Things that don't exist, like the 1918 influenza, same thing. That's about it, right? Now, building any one of these sorts of agents right now is a non-trivial task, but it would also be irresponsible to imagine a future where people aren't eventually doing this sort of work in the same way. And by this sort of work, I mean purposely misapplying biotechnology to cause harm. In other words, it'd be irresponsible not to prepare for this. So I think it's okay to bring attention to issues related to security in this case, but it's significant importance to be clear about what the actual issues are and not to just, talk about it as if it's an amorphous threat. Because once you know what the actual threats are, you can take actions to respond to that.
Drew Endy there. Demis, I know this isn't your field remotely, but it sounds like it could be enormously powerful, this idea of synthetic biology.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting. I mean, I only know a little bit about it. And from what it sounds like, that if we can actually make biology a engineering platform, then, I guess we can try and do all sorts of things with it, like, create artificial viruses for drug delivery, I guess, and I guess it's related to nanotechnology, really, making that happen in the body. So it's very interesting. And I've heard courses at MIT which, teach students to how to build counting machines using the genome and, quite amazing things like that, which, apparently undergrads are doing. So I guess I haven't done anything that's practically useful yet, but I guess it's only been 3 years. So we'll see. He sounds pretty confident.
David, this is one of Craig Venter's pet subjects as well, isn't it? He's trying to build organisms, I think, to save the world.
Yeah, he's trying to do all stuff, isn't he, Craig? He's trying to find organisms, but he's also trying to build them. And I think the one he's trying to build won't do an awful lot, except probably just be alive. I don't think he's actually going to have
that's
any...
Not, sort of, very that's quite a lot. That's not bad. So he'll just create life. Whatever.
No, but we all know life's pretty good. But to me, I don't know. I always thought this field just sounded a bit gimmicky. I think people have done this for decades with GM. They've taken useful traits and have introduced them to other organisms which can use that gene much more efficiently and produce a lot more of what it is that you're trying to produce. And that, to me, is engineering. It's what they call, I suppose, bolt-on, retrofit engineering, but it's still engineering. And I think a lot of this stuff, it sounds really seductive, but in reality, I just don't see what they are going to be able to produce, which is so different from what we already have. Life has evolved over millions and tens and hundreds of millions of years on this planet, and I would have thought we're pretty well adapted to almost everything. And I think,
doesn't it give you an extra insight into how things work if you're actually able to recreate the process yourself?
I think it does, but that's not engineering, that's research. I mean, engineering implies that they're going to produce stuff which
do
is
stuff
useful
with it.
But the thing is, though, is that it could potentially be a lot more powerful than that, because if you're doing just GM, that's sort of tinkering with what you've got. But if they actually fundamentally understand what's going on enough to build it, you could build things that aren't necessarily evolutionary useful, like, for example, oil-producing algae. Why would they want to do that in, as an evolutionary function? But we might want that.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Back in January, The Guardian's George Monbiot attacked Argos as an inefficient product, pumping out a great deal of CO2. He said there is indeed a class war and the campaign against Argos starts here. Well, the company responded as the controversy grew, saying that on the contrary, they were very efficient and modern thinking in adapting and refining a 300-year-old invention. The CEO of Argo Rangemaster, William McGrath, agreed to come into the studio to debate the issue face-to-face with George Monbiot.
We feel that the Argo, by the time you take into account all the role it plays in the home, not only as a cooker, but also as a radiator and providing so many appliances that many people with Argo homes don't need, that actually the Argo home does equate, indeed in many times can, have a better energy performance than comparable homes.
Are you seriously trying to tell me that the average Argo produces less carbon dioxide for the services it delivers than comparable products producing the same services?
Yes.
Okay, so using the kilowatt hours figure that you produce for your Argos, you could boil a kettle for two people, two cups of tea, 99 times a day for the same amount of electricity that your Argo is using.
What the point is, you have to look at the Argo and other products that we do, and where I think you're being unfair in not looking at the role that the Argo or the Rayburn is playing in people's homes.
That was George Monbiot interviewing the CEO of Argo Rangemaster, William McGrath. So, middle-class debate, anybody? Seriously, David, how big a problem do you think these Argos are in the grand scheme of things?
Gosh, in the grand scheme of things, then they're probably not that big a problem, but then neither is one flight or one car or one power station. I think the climate change problem has been caused by thousands and thousands of interventions in our everyday life which burn fossil fuel, of which the Argo is clearly one. Now, some are more potent symbols of climate change than others, and some get demonized more than others. So everyone demonizes flights, for example, they're bad. And now the Argo, I suppose, is becoming, or has become perhaps, a symbol of wasteful use of energy. But I think it's a little bit like fox hunting. It's only because posh people have them that they're a very easy target.
You can hear the full version of the George Monbiot interview with William McGrath at guardian.co.uk/audio. Next week, George Monbiot tackles the silent environmental threat of Fabergé eggs. That's a joke. That's nearly it for this week. But before we go, we've had a lot of comments on our blog following last week's podcast. Most people were discussing an issue our guest Michael Brooks brought up about why we bother having sex. But we also touched on new names for climate change deniers. HRH Pod said,
"Can I suggest the term ostriches or neros for our climate change refuseniks instead of trying to use creationist, which doesn't really make sense because it applies so specifically to a completely unrelated bag of nonsense. I think we need to skip straight to mockery. Ostriches stick their heads in the sand. Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Either one is suitably analogous to those whose salaries depend on them not concurring with the bleeding obvious."
I think that one will run and run. If you want to comment on this week's show, visit our blog at guardian.co.uk/science. And remember, our new science book club is moving on to its second book, The Strangest Man, a biography of the physicist Paul Dirac by Graham Farmelow. It's all on our website. Demis, before we go, you used to be in the computer games industry, working on artificial intelligence. These games seem to have come on leaps and bounds since we had our sort of Ataris playing little sort of ping pong games with invisible tanks and stuff.
I mean, how old are you, Ian?
I'm interested in
PlayStation.
Moving on, I'm interested. Where do you think things are going to be in 10 years' time?
So I think, games have massively improved in the field of graphics, but, we're getting very close to photorealism, which I remember, was a goal of the games industry for the last sort of 15 years, and we're nearly reaching that. But really, if you look at games, we've still got the same type of game, mostly, in terms of the setting and what you have to do in it, which is, mostly about killing or shooting or these kinds of ideas. And I think, it would be great for that to move on. But I think for that to happen, for there to be more compelling settings for games, more akin to films or books, then we're going to need better artificial intelligence. And that's something that hasn't improved at the same speed as graphics. So we're still a long way away from having, intelligent emotional characters in games that sort of react to you in a non-prescripted way.
Nell, you've got a question.
I was going to ask, What do you think is going to be the cultural reach of games in the future? I mean, you get these issues like gold farming where people sit there and rack up points for you that you can play in a completely artificial environment. It's just sort of, it's even beyond anything in sci-fi. Where's it going to go next?
Well, I think that the advent of online games like World of Warcraft, like you say, I mean, has changed things. So that's broadened the appeal of games. But I still don't think we're as broad as many other entertainment media yet in terms of its social influence on a wider scale. So I think there's plenty of work for the games industry to do to reach that wider audience. And I think part of that is going to be better artificial intelligence to make more interesting types of settings that appeal to more types of people.
Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks to Demis Hassabis for coming in, to Nell Bowes and David Adam, and to Francesca Panetta for producing the programme. Alok's back in the presenting seat next week. Till then, goodbye.